Hello and welcome to Spotlight on Transitional Justice. This is a podcast series where we explore the relevance of transitional justice concepts involved in societies involved in ongoing conflicts, with a special focus on Ukraine. Today's episode focuses on the crucial role of witnesses and victims in transitional justice processes and the support mechanisms that need to be in place, especially in courts dealing with international crimes. Today's guest is Wendy LeBuyne, one of the world's leading experts on witness support and witness protection, who's headed witness support units at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia and the Extraordinary Chamber in the Courts of Cambodia, which held trials of former Khmer Rouge leaders. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us today. It's an honor to have you here.
Thanks, Rafik. Shall I just launch in and trust you to edit? Because it touches on the subject you were saying about the reality of Bosnia today. So, do you want me to wait or?
Let me ask you questions and you can launch into it immediately. This was just a short intro.
Yeah.
Wendy, to start us off, can you explain from your experience why victims and witnesses are so essential to war crimes trials, and why do their testimonies hold such a unique value?
Rafik, the simplest answer is that they hold value because they're evidence. And in a war crimes trial, you need evidence to prove a crime. But their stories and their participation brings just a multitude of other layers of meaning. Depending how close to the conflict, like at the Yugoslavia, the ICTY, for some people it was the first coherent rendering of a chaotic period that they were involved in but hadn't made sense of. So sometimes it is about bringing some cohesive story to what happened in that shattering bewilderment. The other thing too is that there are many victims, but there are only ever a few witnesses. And in some ways, those witnesses, even though they're testifying to what they saw, what their personal circumstances were, they're reflecting the experience of a nation. And people will recognize themselves, it will resonate, and they'll go, that happened to me. I saw that happen. I know exactly what happened. I feel like I was there, even though I wasn't there. So they're stitching together a picture of a nation being heard, not just a few witnesses being heard. But I want to put in a proviso there, because a court of law, a crimes court, is not set up to tell a story for people. It's not set up to be a comprehensive picture. It's set up to test evidence against a crime. So there's limits to these, but nevertheless, there is a factor of that in there. And I do want to comment, because it has to be put into any witness preparation. When I say witnesses, it's all witnesses. So at the ICTY and at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, we had witnesses who themselves were responsible for harm. But equally, their testimony is crucial. And so it is important that they're able to testify as free from interference and distress as possible to give what they saw, what they heard, what happened in that crime. And so, in a way, there's certainly in many ways, there's a difference between victim witnesses and perpetrator witnesses, but everybody in a war is affected by that trauma. War's not normal for anybody, and anybody is affected by it, even our players.
Tell me, Wendy, sharing the experiences that you just described in a setting such as a courtroom, especially when it comes to international crimes and the kind of level that these trials reach with participation of top lawyers and judges, this can take an enormous toll on victims, sometimes leading to re-traumatization. From your experience, what kind of impact does testifying have on individuals? What have you observed and witnessed in your work, and how do we work to minimize potentially harmful effects of testifying?
Rafik, there's such a long answer to this, and I might have to illustrate with some stories, because it is both individual and universal. And one of the things that I found is not to be afraid of re-traumatization. What I can say is re-traumatization does happen, can happen, it doesn't have to. But the re-traumatization is a trigger of trauma symptoms and responses that the person might have experienced at the time, that at the events that have been reducing, and it might re-bring them back in greater force. But that re-traumatization, it is not trauma like the first instance. And the witnesses that I saw through it felt almost universally stronger and proud and satisfied that they had done this enormous job. And I remember one young woman from Kosovo, and she was testifying. It was very difficult for her. She was in the courtroom, she was a protected witness, but she was twitchy and she kept like nodding almost as though she was going to sleep. And the judge called me in saying, I think we need to end this testimony. And I spoke to her in the witness waiting room. This is a part about support. As I spoke to her about how you're going in there, and she said, oh, please, please let me go back. I need to do this. I want to do this. I want to do this. So she wasn't aware quite how traumatized she was in the courtroom, because she was experiencing disassociation, which is definitely a strong re-traumatization, but she wanted to do it. And I had to explain to the judges, she wants to get through it. I will sit next to her and she will get through it. And she did. And she was so satisfied, so pleased that she had done this great task for her country, for her people. So I haven't found the re-traumatization to be debilitating. Another example was a witness who lived in a third country, in a wealthy country, and her psychiatrist accompanied her to testify in the ICTY, one of the trials. And he was so nervous for her. He said, I'm just so frightened. I don't want her to go back where she was. She's come a long way in her healing, and it's she was devastated when I first met her. She got through her testimony, and that psychiatrist wrote to me about 6 months later to say she has never looked back. She went from to regaining some inner strength through that experience. So what I'm saying is, yes, it can be re-traumatizing, but with the proper supports, it can be an empowering act for people.
But on that, it's an important point that I think you are best qualified to talk about, and that is the role of psychologists and trauma experts in ensuring that this courtroom environment remains a safe space for victims and witnesses. Can you elaborate a little bit about what kind of skills are required to effectively provide support that you have just described, that we know is often afforded at international tribunals, but not so much in national settings?
Now, this is the difference between national and international. So the ICTY was developed completely without, you know, without the infrastructure of a state. Like, it sat alone in The Hague, unconnected to Bosnia and Herzegovina, and unconnected to the regions that the crimes had occurred. And so everything in that court, the support services had to be duplicated or replicated. But in Cambodia, for example, I was able to use some of the infrastructures of the state, NGOs, health and welfare services, even local police, to weave together a network of support. So it's possible for a country like Ukraine, will have had an existing legal system, they will have had existing support structures that would have supported victims of crimes of violence. So I think for a country like Ukraine, they have an opportunity to leverage the infrastructures they have or had or have to build that level of support, so it doesn't have to be such a big, expensive and attached to the court endeavour. But that does lead me to another thing. One of the differences between other crimes of violence and war crimes is the scale of the destruction. So the scale of the destruction through a war is so complete that lots of the infrastructures of support are destroyed, the police, the hospitals, the welfare system. And so not just that, particularly in a conflict like in former Yugoslavia and I guess in Ukraine, I'm not so familiar, is the loss of men in their peak years, their peak productive years, the loss of the fathers, the sons, the brothers, the uncles, and how over time that condemns the remaining population to an impoverished period because of that loss. So creating war crimes support services overlaid into a country that's lost or damaged a lot of its structures of support and left its country with, you know, boys looking to absent fathers and girls looking to grieving mothers, and this experience of that trauma continues for generations. So that sounds a bit bleak, but notwithstanding, those services don't have to be expensive, they don't have to be specialist, they just have to be trauma informed, which is around how to minimize trauma for victims through every step of the procedure.
Let me jump to a question that I perhaps wanted to ask you later in this conversation, but I think it's quite relevant now. I mean, your experience extends to supporting national systems in developing this kind of expertise and mechanisms, especially when it comes to the court of Bosnia and Herzegovina, where the ICTY played a role of kind of capacity builder, and you have been involved in advising the national authorities in developing their own witness support capacities. What stands out for you from this experience or these experiences as relevant, for instance, to Ukraine to keep in mind?
I'm really glad you asked that question. I know that I made some notes because I really wanted to answer that. Because I think, where did I put it? Hang on. I keep wanting to call you Tariq. You just remind me of Tariq Abdullah. And I have to remember that you're Refik, not Tariq. I think one of the main things that I really liked about being able to do in the former Yugoslavia was, if we think about where a victim sits or a witness sits, they sit in the fabric of their family, of their employer, of their schools, of their medical care system, their doctor. So the NGO system and their major services like housing, all the sorts of things, housing and heating and things that people need. So they're located in that network. The justice system, the cohorts in the justice system are the investigators and the police and the judges and the court administrators. And they're all embedded in the justice system. What I see is that this victim in their network and this justice system have very few ways to connect. And I think one of the most important things that a justice system in crimes like this that affect the whole nation can do is connect with the network of the victims and of their community and vice versa. Now, it might be different in different ways. This is something I took to the War Crimes Chamber in Serbia, to the new chambers in Croatia, to the court of Bosnia and Herzegovina, that to fill that gap between the two, to get some connections so that there is some feedback and some information and some understanding crossways. And yes, I think that was a unique kind of thing to do, and one of the for the court to do, but one of the better outcomes, though, you know, tentative days, which is just 2 days, is the actors from all the judicial three states of the judicial justice systems of the three states, and the NGOs for the three states all came together for 2 days to talk about how to support witnesses that needed to cross borders in order to testify in each other's crimes. And so that's the kind of place that communication and coordination can get you.
Let me now switch over to another aspect of this conversation, and that is witness protection. We will come back. I want to ask you about the kind of role that cultural sensitivity plays in developing effective mechanisms. But
if I could interrupt it, Refik, just to say, though, strangely enough, the War Crimes Chamber for Serbia visited the Cambodian court while I was there, many years later. And a number of those members of that chamber were the same people that I had met when we held those meetings. And they talked about the lasting impact of one of the interventions, which I forgot to mention, which is we brought members of the justice system from each of the three states to The Hague for 2 weeks, and they basically followed us and apprenticed us and took over our duties so they could learn in detail what it is that this court did so that they could return to their home jurisdictions and adapt it so that it's both culturally and linguistically and affordably, economically accessible to those states. And it was the beginning of my interest in how can expensive international justice be transferred by people to their own systems in a way that is actually sustainable. It doesn't have to be so expensive to have justice.
Let me, as I said, cross a bit into witness protection, because this element of interstate cooperation is something that is highly relevant to that. But before I ask you about specifics on witness protection, let's, for our audiences, demystify this and deconstruct it a bit and talk about what are the potential risks that witnesses may face before or after testifying, both real and perceived, that we need to be aware of?
Great, critical question. It's the real and perceived. And this refers back to when we're talking about trauma-informed. The perceived threat and the feeling of fear can be as equally overwhelming for a person for whom an unidentifiable threat can't be found as it can be for a person for whom an identifiable threat can be found. And so one of the things that I see clearly is that witness protection, or some mechanisms of witness protection for the ICTY, started in The Hague separately once the witness list was produced. In fact, the witness protection needed to start right back at the investigative stage. And I know that investigators did plan their own protection mechanisms and take protection actions that they thought would keep their witnesses safe, but they were not integrated with the tribunal's witness protection. So they were like two clashing systems. So the recommendation from me would be that pathway of protection from investigation through to post-testimony will give the clearest indicator of a comprehensive protection program. And just another thing on, it's not just perceived threat, but it's understanding how a legal system works and understanding vulnerability ourselves as a witness. And I am reminded of this story, and it was a Cambodian man, and he was very worried. He was a victim participant. He was very worried that Khmer Rouge would find out that he had written his statement and that he would be penalised. So I talked to him about witness protection, and I said, well, who knows you've given a statement? Let's just start with that. Who knows you've given a statement? He said, nobody. I said, what about your wife? Is it something that she knows? And he said, yes, she knows about it. And I knew he had some grown children. I said, what about your big sons? Is it something you discuss with them? Yes, they know about it. Okay. And I said, what about your community? Because there's a lot of subsistence living, there's a lot of sharing in small communities in rural Cambodia. Would it be something your neighbours would hear about or that you would talk about? Oh, yes, they know, we've talked about it. And I said, well, where were you when you gave your statement? He said, at a community hall. And I said, and about how many people were there? And he said, oh, about 100. So I'm now dealing with someone for at least 100 people knows that he's given that statement. And so I said to him, so given all that, how many people do you think do know about your statement? And he said, nobody. It's a secret. Because what he was telling me is that the way he lives his life, people he knows and trusts are the same as himself. So he's not seeing that as a point of vulnerability. But what it means now is it's too late for some of the witness protection measures of the court, like giving him a pseudonym or non-disclosure of identity, because he's known by so many people. So this is why, for me, witness protection has to be linked with the individual's understanding of what protection is and the court's capacity. Understanding correct, having correct expectations is one of the most important things to having a witness feel satisfied with their testimony. So that's one. The second one was a young woman from Bosnia who was so fearful for her life. She was convinced she was in danger and she saw danger everywhere. There was no identifiable threat, but in my view, she still required a protection support service, which is about analysing her life and putting in place some measures that would increase her sense of safety. It's not something that can just be solved by counselling or, you know, trauma treatment when that level of fear is so high and people who are particularly, who potentially were part of the people who cause you harm exist all around you. So I'm labouring this a bit, but it's a bit about individual understanding and expectation. So the mechanisms have to start from the very beginning, and the ones in the court, in my view, the police keep a bit of mystique about witness protection. So they're unwilling to talk at length about what it actually is. And I think that's because they're very basic and practical measures, and that people hope there's actually a magic way of being safe. In fact, we know how if somebody is determined to cause you harm and they have the resources and the capacity and the time, it is very difficult to keep you safe. The President of America got shot. The Pope got shot. It is very difficult to protect a person when resources are directed at harming them. So that's the threat analysis is critical. Who would be interested in causing harm? What resources do they have? What capacity and interest do they have?
Leading from that is the question that I wanted to ask you. When establishing witness protection programs, you just named one of the biggest challenges, and that is the intent of those who in reality want to cause harm to witnesses. What are some of the other common challenges that tribunals face in establishing such witness protection programs that perhaps Ukraine can preemptively address?
I think the communication, but for most of us, the first point of safety for us is the local police. They're the people who are in reaching distance, who you call. And so for me, negotiating with local police and setting up a mechanism with them to respond to witness protection is really important. I remember one point, I'm not sure that I remember this clearly, so it may not be a good example, but it was a witness who wanted some disguising witness protection measures to keep it a secret that he was testifying. And but in fact, maybe it was based from one of the courts in Africa, but in fact it was easier for his community leader to call the township together and say, this person is a witness. If anybody harms this witness, I will track them down. I will spend my life tracking them down and bringing them to justice. And you have to mean it, and you have to be able to do it if you would so openly expose somebody like that. But sometimes secrecy is not the only method. So I've lost my train of thought then.
No, basically, we were talking about challenges that courts in Ukraine may face in establishing these witness protection programs and how they can preemptively address them.
Yes, yeah, so I was thinking that's one. The one level is what can you lay on the ground that acts as a rapid response and acts to protect
the local police element.
Yeah. And then what are the infrastructures that the court can use to either hide your identity, well, really hide your identity is basically what it comes down to in most respects, so that it's not known that you testified. Now, this can be very difficult, but we had one witness in The Hague, and it took a lot of planning. Maybe this is the key to what I want to say to you. It's individualising the plan. So this was a witness who lived in another country. He had a daughter living in another country. I think 6 to 8 months before he testified, he started telling all his friends, his employers, everybody that he was going to visit his daughter and he was going to stay for 3 months because it was such a big deal to have to go and visit her. And then he did go and stay with his daughter and he had his return plane tickets. And then we picked him up from his daughter's residence and brought him to The Hague, and he testified that he returned to his daughter's residence, finished out his 3-month stay and went home. So that protected him by using secrecy, but with a plan that suited his, that fit his circumstances, that was plausible and that could be used. So I think individual planning for protection is key for the highest threats. But the one thing I notice is that the war crimes trials that I've been involved in, the threat has never been high, like a Colombian drug trial, you know, where the assault rate against potential witnesses is grievous and other circumstances. So I haven't found the threats to be as high as those in the war crimes courts.
Let's talk about the resources required and international cooperation. Ukraine, as we know, has a lot of support from Western countries and others in pursuing accountability for crimes committed during the Russian invasion. What are the key concerns to keep in mind when establishing a witness protection program, especially taking into account this international dimension, possible international dimension, considering that we are talking about another country attacking you?
Yes. I think, first of all, dividing the language of dividing support and protection is something that started at the ICTY, and I'd like to see it disappear forever. Because if those two aren't integrated, it can't be a comprehensive service. So when I think about, I think more of witness services that are supportive and that are protective. And that includes the logistics of moving witnesses to and fro need to be supportive and protective. It was interesting at some points in both in the Yugoslav Tribunal and in the Khmer Rouge Tribunal is that I looked to women's services, women in family violence situations, where some of those organisations, NGOs, were coming up with really creative ways of protecting women. And with all respect to our law enforcement officers, the police is not normally an institution you go to for creative new thinking or, you know, challenging new ideas or, you know, piloting radical thoughts. And so I think we have to look to some of the more marginal services that do deal with protection issues like family violence services to glean from them what are they using that is protective, because they face very similar challenges that the families are known and might be part of a small community. Moving far away is not realistic. There can be children and parents involved, a whole lot of similar kinds of factors. So I think examining, ransacking the mechanisms for protection and adapting them for these circumstances is a path we should take, because my anxiety at the moment is that we keep repeating the initial programs of the ICTY and that they're not comprehensive enough, that they're too based in the Western notion of individual threat. They're not, they don't convey well, like my Cambodian man who told 100 people. They don't translate well to other culture and cultural practices and community ways of living. And certainly you will know this, even from Bosnia, families in the smaller rural towns, the idea of keeping a secret from anybody is just practically impossible. And so I think that it needs rethinking. I think witness protection services are often defensive because, you know, they're up against it. They've got to keep people alive. And but it does need some major rethinking and some creative thought. And I think probably the best way for a country like Ukraine to do it is, again, communicate with its own citizens. People will tell you what will keep them safe. Asking the person rather than imposing a system on them is a first step.
Naturally leading from this, and you have already mentioned several times in your answers, is the role for civil society and various local organization networks when it comes to, I agree, with victims and witness services, support and protection. Especially in the time after the testimony is over, when the courts naturally kind of not lose their capacity to continue protecting or not protecting as much as supporting, but simply don't have the same resources. What role for civil society in this?
Refi, you make a point, though, that can be said very clearly to witnesses. Once their testimony is given, the court's role is over. And it's really important we communicate this directly and clearly to witnesses, because there is a lot of expectation from witnesses that there will be some sort of continuing support. And for the court's purposes, for collecting evidence to hear crimes, it is over. So it's important that witnesses know that. This is, again, about adjusting their expectations. Now, I think there's an enormous role for civil society and NGOs and a whole host of players, as I was saying, you know, both in the communicating with the court side, but also during the during proceedings, not in an interfering way with the court evidence and legal issues. Maybe I can summarise it by saying this. Courts have to be the gatekeepers. They have to have the highest integrity. They have to keep the processes clean. They have to keep the evidence clean. They have to control the gate. However, I think they have been known to keep that gate too closely closed, that there are ways of opening and inviting civil society and organisations into aspects of the operation of the court that doesn't need to threaten any of those things. Finally, is that if civil society is supporting witnesses after their testimony or finding ways to support them, it's absolutely imperative that the court doesn't send out a more damaged person than it came in. So this is why the court processes are so important, that the witness has to leave in well supported enough not to then become like a kind of need extensive services from an under-resourced civil society, because a lot of these services don't have a lot of resources. They exist, they stretch a penny a mile trying to keep their community cared for. And we were very lucky in Cambodia because there was a good organisation, the Psychosocial Support Centre, and who were supported by both international, mostly international, I think, funding. I'm not sure, domestic funding as well. But they were able to build a team to support witnesses right through the process at the Cambodian court. So they could meet witnesses beforehand if they were with the witness unit. They supported them during their testimony, on the day of testimony, and they offered follow-up services of care afterwards. And they also did some pretty powerful actions, like their a program they had to build a story of a witness's whole experience. So the court just wants a part of that experience, but this agency supported witnesses to write their whole experience, and it was given to them as once it was written by them, it was given to them as a document, as a family history document, and it was such a nice way of concluding that whole experience. So I think domestically, Ukraine can burrow down its existing people and skills and find those ways that are suitable for the Ukrainian nation.
Let me ask you a couple of questions that are specifically focused on Ukraine. And one of the elements here is the scale of the conflict and the crimes that are being committed and the cases that are being investigated by the state prosecutor. How can, in such a scenario, support services be scaled up to meet such a demand?
It's hard. A court can't service a traumatized population. So it really is about the court building a capacity for the numbers that it will deal with. Now, Refik, I'm not familiar enough to know what kind of numbers of witnesses they'll be dealing with, what number of crimes they will be prosecuting, and I guess it would be more on the scale of Bosnia's work than Cambodia's work, where they focus very narrowly on a couple of charges due to the age of the accused. So I think, again, it would be about thinking locally. What are the regions that witnesses will be coming from? What are the regions where the crimes that have occurred? What is left there? Have people moved away? This was for all the courts, witnesses who fled their countries and now reside in other countries. And for those witnesses, there can be a whole host of complications like visa, exit and re-entry conditions on a visa, if they're asylum seekers, for example, or just a range of issues that are harder and more expensive to solve when the person doesn't live in the country where the crimes are being heard. So I think that's it. So looking regionally or locally at the crimes, what services exist, where the witnesses will be coming from, what they already have and what can be strengthened.
Go ahead.
No, I was just thinking the way to maximise resources is to strengthen the community. If you and I were victims of violent crime, we would go to our family, our husbands, our wives, our parents, our children, our friends, the doctor we trust, our employer if we needed time off. We use the infrastructure around us to recover. And so in a war crime, when that is so fraught and so damaged, people are left with so little to support them in every aspect of their life. So strengthening community would be the way. A stronger community means better support for witnesses.
You mentioned, I'll just touch on that again. You mentioned the fact that in this context, like other contexts where you worked, one of the challenges is the fact that a huge number of those witnesses and victims are displaced or within the country or abroad. How can Ukraine ensure that they have access to these justice processes and the necessary support mechanisms?
That's really pretty high level negotiating with the states of residence of the witnesses, whether they would testify in the cases happening in Ukraine or whether countries themselves will be prosecuting perpetrators outside the country if for whatever reason they were arrested in another country and that country has the capacity to hear charges. So it's likely to be something that they will have to deal with, and in some cases we had to have very special negotiations with the country in order to allow a witness to travel. I think now, with technology being so much improved around internet communication, we did in Cambodia a lot of video link testimony, much more than we ever did at the ICTY, and that was to do with people living in other countries. And so sometimes I would have to approach the country of residence, like France, and they would arrange to free up a courtroom and a court officer to sit with the witness while they gave the evidence by video link. In other cases, New York, witnesses gave evidence from UN properties, so they weren't giving evidence from American territory. So there was a lot of variables in there. It's very difficult to give a global answer.
Many individuals are, and perhaps even communities in Ukraine, are now facing a situation where they need to be preparing mentally and emotionally to one day be witnesses in these trials. What is the role of, let's say, the legal counsel, people who will be investigating and prosecuting these crimes, in terms of preparing them and helping them prepare? What kind of a training do they need outside of, you know, specialists who work in witness support units? What do they need to know?
It's the involvement of legal counsel varies. So in Cambodia, investigators would take statements and they were provided to the legal teams. The legal teams never spoke to the witnesses. They met them that day in court. The witnesses would read their statements before they go back into court, and then they would testify to their statements in the court. So very different. That was a civil law system, very different to the ICTY, where witnesses went through something that was called proofing, where legal teams would go through the statement with the witness and clarify issues and sort out what they were going to focus on. And then the witness would be much more prepared when they would go into court. So it would depend what the legal system is and where the avenues are, but there is very simple and practical information about the sensitivity required, and some of it is so simple. It's about telling a victim witness, particularly if you've got someone who's been imprisoned, you know, locked up, is that how long the interview before will take, how long it will take, and when the breaks will be, build in lots of breaks, stick to them, build trust by showing yourself to be reliable at all of those soft points. Make sure the witness can see an exit or a door so they're not feeling trapped. Tell them, witnesses are often nervous, they drink a lot of water, have as much water as they want. Tell them toilet breaks are embraced, they are welcomed, and they should go to the toilet 100 times if they want. It's about breaking down all of those possible barriers for witnesses so that they can feel comfortable and build trust. And then the interviewer, the legal officer, has to be trustworthy. They cannot go over the time they said they would finish because they ran out of time, they thought it would take longer. That is a betrayal of trust when you're working with someone who's had the ultimate betrayal of trust. So that's only a tiny insight to it, and there is a, I can write a list of all the things of that investigators and legal staff should be aware of when they're interviewing witnesses who've been through such incredible trauma. But the material is there, and I think that the more that Ukraine can incorporate that into their training, the better outcome they'll have with their witnesses. And I say that, and I want to throw in a horror story, because it happens with an investigator who wanted the evidence, wanted to finish a statement. The witness was completely broken down, so the investigator purchased an over-the-counter sedative from a pharmacy and gave it to the witness so they could continue taking the evidence. That is just, it is both shocking treatment of another human being, but it is also it's re-traumatizing much more than taking a witness stand, and it is a betrayal of your integrity and their trust.
There are various different examples that I'm aware of also the importance of communication. I know of a story of a man who was basically interviewed preliminarily about the death of his son, and ultimately it was decided that there were simply too many people who could testify about that same incident, that he was not invited to the courtroom to testify. And because there was no feedback on what happened and why this was decided, this man spent years believing that he actually failed on the day, that he did not tell the story right. And so he failed his dead son in not being able to actually do him justice and tell his story properly so that he gets his time in court. The importance of communication, both from the staff and the courts in general, I think cannot be underestimated. But can you just reflect on that somewhat, and also on the role of media and public outreach and what they can do to ensure that victims and witnesses feel confident in coming forward and participating in this trial?
I completely understand that witness and how he would have felt, and how it could he not feel that in the absence of feedback. And I'll just move on. I'll answer something else before I go on to the role of outreach. But it was... I've just gone blank for a second, Rafik. Hang on.
We were talking about the importance of feedback and communication.
Yes. Investigators, because of the level of fear of some of the witnesses from Bosnia, they were witnesses were really appealing for witness protection measures. And the investigators didn't want to tell them that they couldn't identify a threat, that they wouldn't be given any protection, or they weren't going to be recommending protection measures. And certainly a number of witnesses were interested in relocation. They just wanted to get out of there and never have to be confronted with that environment again. But what they used to say, instead of telling the truth about witness protection capability, they used to say, oh, there's a unit in The Hague that takes care of all of that. So you'll see them when you get there. And then I'm left with devastated witnesses who find out the truth when they get there and have become panic-stricken. How can I go home? I thought there was going to be whatever they thought there was going to be. And that this is it's appalling, but it's also just a lack of clear communication. What I found with witnesses, when I was clear, when I would say to them, you are not going to be granted protection measures, they're in these circumstances, yours doesn't meet them, they accepted it and they understood. Another one was something like, when people are desperate, they try and barter what they've got. And so sometimes we had a case where a witness's testimony was wanted, so they're trying to barter. Well, I'll testify for you if you do something for me. And so this is about having to explain to witnesses really careful, just clearly, that there can be no exchange, there can be no bartering, and that witnesses were not coerced to appear. It sometimes investigators would lose their evidence because a witness wouldn't testify because they weren't satisfied about the protection arrangements or other arrangements. But my experience was telling witnesses the truth resonated with them, and many of them, all of them, put their fears aside and stepped forward and did it.
Now, reflecting on the role of media and public outreach and its importance.
I think outreach is absolutely critical because it is that part, it's linked to what I'm saying about it touches the real lives of the people. Outreach is in the communities. It's translating an experience that people may not be able to imagine. And I don't know what it would be like in Ukraine, but for, obviously, a former Yugoslavia had a sophisticated legal system, but the one that people were familiar with wasn't the one they found in The Hague. So there was always this kind of, what's going on here? Because this doesn't look like what I thought it would be. For Cambodia, it was a huge gulf because a lot of those people had never experienced a judicial justice system before. So they were completely unprepared for what they were going to expect. And I used to, of what was going to happen. And I used to like saying how nature hates a vacuum because witnesses would fill their heads with what they think might happen. And that's got to be cleared out of the way before they can experience what is going to happen. And so, I must be getting tired. I'm losing my thought. So being clear. And outreach knows how to adapt the messages. There's no point me adapting a message for a Cambodian audience. I need a Cambodian person who understands the message and then adapts it for that audience. And this is about cultural sensitivity, is recognising that the Western world doesn't have all the answers, the International Crimes Tribunal doesn't have all the answers, that the experts don't have all the answers. And finding the people in the community, of the community, who are the experts in their own culture so that they can translate messages in an accessible way is absolutely vital.
Let's then conclude on a kind of overall general framework for these issues. How important is it, in your opinion, for Ukraine to develop a long-term strategy for witness and victim support and protection to deal with all these challenges that you have so well identified and described? And what, in your opinion, could this strategy look like in terms of what elements needs to cover?
I have to apologize for my lack of knowledge about the situation around these potential cases in Ukraine. And I'm actually reflecting back on a long, long time ago when I worked for the Foundation for Survivors of Torture here in Melbourne in Australia. And I was asked to visit with the remnants of the Burmese Student Army. And that was a group of young students who protested Gosh, I can't even remember the year, maybe the late 70s, early 80s, I can't even remember, and had gone, taken themselves into the jungle and formed an army. And some documentary makers who had met the remnants of this army were worried about the levels of trauma, invited me to come and make some sort of assessment of what could be done. Terrific. Those people were living in active warfare. Their whole focus was on survival, not on strategizing, not on recovery. In fact, one of the leaders asked me, is there a psychological test that could tell him which of the members of his group would be the best at hand-to-hand combat? So it, in some parts, it depends what the what state Ukraine infrastructure and judicial system and Ministry of Justice and all, what state are they in to begin to plan something when they're still in under active conflict with what looks to me very unpredictable, what might happen next. So I can only suggest that it's starting with the brain test. I fear I'm going to repeat myself, starting by looking at what was in place, what is still in place, how to leverage it. That country will not have the money to rebuild everything to make the kind of seamless witness experience that they might have had before this conflict or that they would hope for. But to build enough security, safety and support so that witnesses can get through that evidence giving and that those decisions can be made on whether those crimes have occurred and what the suitable consequences should be.
Wendy, this has been truly, for me, and I'm sure for our listeners in Ukraine, a fascinating, rich conversation with so much to take away from. Let's end it with a message from you. What would be, based on everything that we discussed and your experience that spans so many years in this field, a message to both victims and potential witnesses in Ukraine and those who are in charge of creating these support mechanisms?
They are one. The victims, the witnesses, the mechanisms in charge of creating are one, working for one country. And so I guess that's just to keep in my own head the fact that they are working together. But I wanted to, if I left with one message, it's one that I've given before, Refik, but it has just truly stayed with me as the most critical part of the work of a witness unit, and a witness unit meaning both protection and support. And that is that there are three aspects of testifying that need to be worked through with witnesses. And that is, with the witnesses, what are their motivations for testifying? Why are they coming? What are they doing this for? Then, mapped against their expectations, what are they expecting? What are they going to find? What will it be like? What will they be left with? And then, if those two motivations, expectations, are reflected in reality, that's an actual experience, is what happened, then that seems to lead to the cohesion, to enough cohesion for a witness to leave satisfied that they have done the job that they came to do, regardless of all of the missing parts that we wish were there. And as for motivations, it's another thing I've often said, Ravik, so I don't know to hear it again, but really over the years I saw four main motivations that witness gave for testimony, and one of them was to speak for the dead. Frequently parents speaking for a dead child, or it could be even in religious terms, like a person saying, God let me survive, God must have let me survive for a purpose, this must be the purpose, I have to testify. Or it can even be in traumatic terms, like the ghosts of all the dead are talking to me and they won't be quiet unless I testify. So whatever the actual detail was, it's to speak for the dead. The second area was to tell the story, that this horror can't be known unless the story is told. And these people sometimes don't leave satisfied because they don't get a chance to tell their story. They get a chance to answer specific questions by the legal parties. And so it's important that they know beforehand that this is what's going to happen, so they don't leave dissatisfied that their motivation didn't get to be fulfilled to tell their story. Another group come because they want justice. Now that's a bit simpler for courts to manage because that's their business. So they say, this is wrong, this is a crime, this has to be heard and it has to be punished. And so they leave satisfied because they were able to do that. But for victim witnesses, they often find that the consequences were less than they had expected. And so there's often a real disappointment or even a bitterness if they feel a prison sentence was too low. Like, that's the time where they need extra attention in the follow-up because of the devastation at hearing, even if it is a guilty conviction, at what they see as the paucity of the sentence. Or if it's an innocent conviction and they're a victim, the level of frustration is high. And the final group, and this is usually women, and it's in the hope that these crimes won't happen again. So believing that if they put themselves forward, if they testify, if the world does something, it might bring an end to these kind of crimes. And of course that we don't know yet.
Wendy Lobwane, thank you so very much for this conversation. It has been a pleasure talking to you about these difficult issues, but I'm sure it will be extremely informative and useful for our audiences. Thank you for your expertise and thank you for your time.
Pleasure, Refik. Are you going to hang up now or are we going to have a quick chat?
Let me just...